Life of Caliph Ali by Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi. Chapter 12. The Shiite Doctrine of Imamate. The discussion in the foregoing pages has made it abundantly clear that the members of the Prophet's household subscribed to the accepted faith of Islam which had received from the Prophet. It consisted of Tawheed, the oneness of God, and the finality of the Prophethood. It was the faith held by the great majority of Muslims, the Ahle Sunnah, that the revelation from God had ceased, the faith of Islam had been in its final shape, and the grace and blessings of God in this world as well as the deliverance in the hereafter rested on placing trust in these doctrines. They knew that God had said, quote, "Today I have perfected your religion for you, and I have completed my blessings upon you, and I have approved Islam for your religion," unquote, as is said in the Quran. Now there remained no possibility of any new prophet being sent by God, nor was any methodology to be adopted for lawmaking under the Sharia. No addition or subtraction was to be made to the basic doctrines of Islam. Ali bin Abu Talib and his descendants firmly held, as their biographical accounts and related literature show, these very articles of faith. Sufyan relates from Mutrif and Mutrif from Shabi, on the authority of Abu Hujaifa, quote, "I asked Ali whether he had received anything directly from the Prophet in addition to the Quran, which was not known to others. He replied, 'I swear by God, who has the seed and gives birth to every sentient being, that I have nothing except the intelligence which is bestowed by God to a few for the comprehension of the Quran and that which I have in writing.'" Unquote. On being asked further what he had in writing, he said, fine for manslaughter of a Muslim, release for a prisoner, and that a Muslim is not to be slain for a disbeliever." Unquote. Psychological backdrop of the Imamate. The members of the Prophet's household had given faith to the creed held collectively by all the Muslims. They considered themselves bound to follow the Quran and the Sunnah like any other Muslim. They knew that only one's actions and morals and learning and awe of God entitled anyone to be respected by others. They were convinced of the correctness of the Quranic dictum, quote, "Lo, the noblest of you in the sight of Allah is the best in conduct," unquote. Subsequently, however, the bygone traditions of the holy order propagated by ancient religions and nurtured by the antiqued thought and culture of Greece, Iran, India, and China reasserted itself amongst the sections of new converts to Islam. The ancient thought, almost universally accepted, had been that families, which had somehow come to assume a sacred character through their religious function or travels, or by attaining higher spirituality, were incarcerations of supernatural power and were agents of gods. They had a special position above law and enjoyed powers to make and unmake the law. There are certain predictions and subjective factors that make this doctrine acceptable to the people. Number one, it serves as a protection against personal responsibility and accountability, since the precept shifts the liability to the particular family, the class of people or individual representing that family and class, and that it is just enough to have confidence in them, nothing else. Two, it is easier to submit to any particular family or individual by placing confidence in or showing reverence and obedience to them than to abide by a complete code of canons prescribing injunctions of all matters which are further elucidated by juristic opinions of the scholars. Number three, to exploit any particular family or an individual or even a group of people for one's profit is comparatively easier and the smoothest way to achieve power and prestige. This method can be helpful for any crafty person in realizing his selfish ends through little effort by gaining confidence of a people or a family deemed as infallible by the people, while fame and honor and popularity amongst the masses demand hard and continuous labor. Many a Machiavellian person had utilized this method to his personal advantage. The Athna Ashari sect has found this creed of racial and hereditary sanctity helpful in securing its political and personal ends, and that is why it was cloaked with sacredness as an article of faith. This sect allowed itself to believe that the successors of the Prophet and the Imams were appointed by God, who are impeccable like the messengers of God. They hold that it is incumbent on every Muslim to obey them, since they enjoy parity with the Prophet of Islam and are higher in rank than the apostles, than other apostles of God. The obligation man owes to God cannot be fulfilled in the absence of an Imam, or the obedience to God is complete without knowing the Imam. The world would not last without an Imam, and to know him is an essential postulate of the faith. The obedience to the Imam is similar to that of the prophets, and they have the authority to declare anything lawful as unlawful, or vice versa. As the Imams are innocent and sinless like the prophets of God, the one who gives faith to their impeccability becomes entitled to paradise even if he were a tyrant or was wicked. The Imams are on par with the blessed Prophet, but higher than any other created beings. The deeds for all are brought to the notice of the Imam twice, in the day and in the night, and then the angels call upon them at all times. They experience a session every Friday night on the occasion of Laylatul Qadr. Every year they receive a new scripture from God. They have the authority over life and death and govern this world and the next with full power to award whatever they like to anyone. The following reports find a place in Usul al-Kafi. Quote, Hassan bin Abbas al-Marufi wrote to Imam Ali Raza, quote, May I be ransom for you. Kindly tell me the difference between an apostle, a prophet, and an imam. He wrote in reply, quote, The difference between an apostle, a prophet, and an imam is that Jibreel comes to an apostle who sees and hears the angel, receives revelation of God through him, and often sees him in dreams, as did Ibrahim. A prophet sometimes hears Jibreel and often sees him too. An imam hears the angel but does not see him. Unquote. The noted historian Ibn Khaldun has given an objective description of the Shiites' doctrine of imamate. He says, quote, For the Shia, the imamate is not one of the social requirements left to the discretion and wisdom of the community, nor the people vested with that authority is elected by the Muslims. Imamate is rather an essential article of faith, a fundamental creed of Islam to them. No prophet can ignore it, nor entrust the responsibility of his election to his followers. It is the duty of the prophet to appoint an imam for the community of believers, and such an imam is clear of all sins, which are major and minor. Ali was the person whom the Prophet of Islam had appointed to that office. Ibn Khaldun further says, quote, There are over credulous sects amongst them which exceed the faith of limit of faith and reason by assigning divinity to the imam. They maintain that the imams were human beings, but they were possessed divine attributes, or God had entered into their human frame. Infusion of divine spirit, or the world made flesh, is in fact a Christian creed in regard to Jesus Christ. Those subscribing to this creed about Ali got burnt by him. When Muhammad bin Hanafiyyah was informed that Mukhtar bin Ubaidah had faith in this creed, he imprecated upon him and declared that he had nothing to do with such a belief. The behavior of Ja'far as-Sadiq with such people was also the same. These sects also include those who believe that the sublimity possessed by the imams cannot be attained by anybody else, and hence when an imam dies, that sublimity is transferred to the next imam. This creed is known as transmigration. Unquote. The concept of imamate has been maintained by Athna Ashari sect down the ages without any change or modification, because it constitutes one of the fundamental articles of belief. This is the creed still held by it, including Imam Khomeini, who writes in his book, quote, The Imam occupies the glorious station, the supreme place, and wields such a delegated authority of Genesis that everything in this universe submits to his glory. In accordance with the accepted tenets of our religion, neither any angel of the highest rank or anyone such as a prophet can attain the sublime position of an imam. He related a hadith from the great prophet, and the imams existed before the creation of the cosmic order in the form of light, encircling the throne of God and enjoying such closeness to him as is known only to God. Unquote. The unhealthy influence exerted by such an exaggerated concept of imamate has been noticed even by non-Muslim scholars. Patrick Hughes writes in the Dictionary of Islam, quote, many of the Shia have carried their veneration for Ali as far as to raise him to the position of divinity or a divine person, and most of the sects make their imam partakers of divine nature. Unquote. Another Western scholar says in the shorter Encyclopedia of Islam, quote, with the light of imamate continually flowing in the world, the institute of prophetship or apostleship occupied only an annexillary position, unquote. The Iranian influence. In fact, a delicate doctrine like the imamate, which goes beyond racial and lineal chauvinism to raise the status of imam to the position of divinity, reflects the ancient creed of the Iranians, which has the divine origin of the kings. In the ancient Iran, religious and temporal authority was concentrated in the hands of a tribe known as Media. After Zoroastrianism consolidated its hold on the country, religious leadership came to be held by the Almoghan tribe. The caste-ridden Iran had a priestly class which was believed to be the shadow of God on earth. All men were created to serve that class, and the class itself was for the service of God. It was therefore essential that the ruler of the country should belong to the priestly tribe. In the estimation of the Iranians, the ruler was an incarceration of God, and it was his prerogative to be the chief priest at the fire altar. Dr. Ahmad Amin, an eminent Egyptian scholar, quotes in his book, quote, Iranians equated their monarch with God and paid a similar regard to the royal family. They held that the obedience to the imam was not only obligatory, but a submission to him also meant obedience to God. Unquote. Such an absolute reliance on any particular family or class of people and acceptance of his monopoly over religious and temporal leadership had led the followers of certain ancient religions to bend their knees before human beings instead of God, and numbed their freedom of thought and intellectual capabilities by festering their minds and setting in stagnation amongst them. Oftentimes, people have been mercilessly exploited socially and economically because of this way of thought. In the medieval ages, letters of atonement and redemption and keys to heaven were sold by the popes. The blind faith in the church led to bloody struggle between science and priesthood, which ultimately led to the separation of state and religion, and then to the rejection of everything connected with faith. Secularization of the state occupied by Muslim countries had unnecessarily and without any justification pushed them to a constant internal conflict between their ruling class and the masses who desire Islamic law to be enforced as the law of the land in these countries. They are now wasting their energy and resources in their internal conflict instead of conserving them to fight their enemies. The imamate is a concept parallel to prophethood, but the worst part of it is that it confers dictatorial powers on those who wield authority and makes them competent to legislate new laws or to abrogate divine laws. Slavish submission to such rulers, if they also happen to be religious leaders, has empowered these rulers with the authority to invalidate even the obligatory practices of Islam for political reasons. They exercise this authority by virtue of their claim to be appointed by God and representing the sinless imams. A recent example of this furnished by the message of Imam Khomeini to Sayyid Ali Khomeini, published in the book The Organ of the Iranian Government, in the issue number 182, dated 23rd Jamadi al-Ula 1408. The message said, quote, government can suspend or order demolition of any mosque. The government takes precedence over prayers and fasting. The government is directly derived from the prophethood and constitutes its initial and fundamental commandments. It is therefore has priority over secondary directives, including those relating to prayer, fasting, and pilgrimage. The ruler has the authority to suspend any mosque, and if need arises in order to demolish any mosque, it can scrap even Islamic precepts, whether they pertain to devotional exercises or any other matter, if they appear to be injuring the interests of Islam. If the government deems it to be the interest of the Islamic State, it can suspend pilgrimage, although it is one of the most important obligatory devotional exercises of Islam. It is because the government in itself represents the autonomous vicegerency of God, unquote. Now, it is manifestly clear that this suspension or abrogation of obligatory religious practices or making changes in the religious injunctions has having a sanction of the Quran and the Hadith by any individual, whether because of his juristic opinion or in view of political requirements, is extremely dangerous for an eternal religion. It can result in apostasy of an Islamic country or nation. Such a blind obedience to the government can render religion ineffective and pave the way to a situation which cannot be overcome later on. The fruitless conflict between Iran and Iraq, which lingered on for several years and inflicted great harm on both countries, illustrates the dangers inherent in this concept. This war came to an end in August 1988 with great difficulty owing to huge losses and destruction and internal unrest in one country and intervention of superpowers in the other. The Imamate wielding absolute power and demanding unquestioning obedience becomes a dictator, which can be a menace to world peace. It can endanger peace, law and order, agriculture and trade, in short, the very existence of human race. Dictatorship has posed several threats to humanity in earlier times too, but when such an absolute authority assumes sanctity under religion, claims to be faultless, and deems itself as commissioned by God by representing prophethood, its perilous threats increase many times. It can be suicidal for a country or a nation or any sect giving faith to it, and there will be no escape for it from the danger. This concept of exaltation and veneration for any group or class of people gives rise to parasites which are indolent and indiscreet. They squander national wealth on their own pleasures and amusement, increase unemployment among people, open the doors to tyrannical feudal systems of the medieval ages, and sow the seeds of stagnation in the intellectual and religious spheres. The chosen few exploit the working classes, fundamental rights of the citizens are trampled upon, and the class of work-shy, lazy people comes forth, which profits by the labor of others. Verily, God has said in truth, quote, O believers, many of the rabbis and monks indeed consume the goods of people in vanity and bar from God's way, unquote. The blind and zealous obedience to Imam Khomeini by his followers, investing him with a sacrosanct authority so long as he lived, amply demonstrates that this concept violates the Sharia and is against the notion of Tawheed, thus explained by the Quran, quote, It belongs not to any mortal that God should give him the book, the judgment, the prophethood. Then he should say to men, quote, be you servants to me apart from God. Rather, be you masters in that you know the book and in that you study. He would never order you to take the angels and the prophets as lords. What would he order you to disbelieve after you have surrendered to Allah? Unquote. International news agencies reported that when Ayatollah Khomeini died 3rd of June 1989 at Tehran, the Iranian government made agreements to convey his corpse to the Jannat-e-Zuhra cemetery on a vehicle, but the people burst in on the corpse in such a large manner that it was impossible to carry it on the vehicle. A helicopter was engaged to carry the corpse to the cemetery, but there to the frenzied crowd of millions of people crashed in to take away the shreds of his coffin as a relic, leaving the corpse naked. Repeated announcements, warnings, and even shots fired in the air absolutely had no effect on the mob, and the naked corpse fell down on the ground, and ultimately the government had to postpone the burial, which took place after several hours. News reports also say that the Iranian government intends to build a magnificent museum for him, which will be the finest in the world. It can be designed on the pattern of the Kaaba and the tomb of Imam Ali Raza. Obviously, billions would be spent to make it to make another Taj Mahal of Agra. Also, all of this has nothing but the manifestation of the creed of the Imamate, endued with divinity, vesting mortals with impeccability and sanctioning undeserved by human beings. It is the elevation of man to the status of supernatural being, which had been done away with by the teachings of the Prophet. The most reliable and authentic reports about the character and behavior of the Prophet tell us that he never liked any distinctive treatment, even for himself, nor approved any exaltation as the followers of other religions usually did about their prophets. He told his followers simply to treat him as an apostle and a servant of God. Anas is reported to have said, quote, "Nobody was dearer to us than the messenger of God, peace and blessings of God be upon him. But he never stood up as a mark of respect. But we never stood up as a mark of respect for him because we knew he did not like it. When someone addressed the Prophet as, O best of creation, he replied, this is the status enjoyed by Ibrahim alayhi salam. Umar ibn al-Khattab relates that the Prophet said, do not extol me like the Christians who glorify Isa ibn Maryam. I am a servant of God. If you have to say anything about me, say only that I am a servant and an apostle of God," unquote. The Prophet of Islam tried his best that his followers should not commit the mistake of magnifying or paying tribute to him, bordering to divinity like the followers of other religions, who sometimes exalted even the learned and the elect amongst them to a similar manner. Just before the Prophet wielded his breath, he said, quote, "May God ruin the Jews and the Christians, for they have turned the graves of their prophets into places of worship," unquote. Aisha and Ibn Abbas relate that when the time of the Prophet's eternal rest drew near, he pulled a sheet over his face and then, feeling restlessly, removed it. It was in this condition that he uttered these words. He meant to warn the Muslims against such a practice. The Prophet always forbade lamentation and beating of breasts over anyone's death. The purpose was to create an abiding faith in the Almighty, which was to be evinced through all utterances and deeds of the Muslims. His guidance and training was fully demonstrated by the action of his followers when he died. His companions loved and revered him as nobody had been ever loved more than themselves, their belongings, and their children, but nobody shed a tear nor gave expression of his sorrow in the manner which was forbidden by the Prophet. Not even Ali, Hassan, and Hussein, who were the nearest to him, showed up their distress. It was because all of them had an unflinching faith in Tawheed and the oneness of God. Contrarily, the lamentation of the Iranians brought up with the belief of impeccability of the Imamate, which reflects their ancient Zoroastrian creed, found expression in their mourning for a man as if he had been an angelic being. The first four Khalifas. An appraisal of the rightly guided caliphate comprising the rule of the first four Khalifas as the combination of people brought together by providence, although they differed in their ways and their objectives and working, or that they pursued different policies and programs with the varied outlooks and inclinations, and had nothing in common except their unflinching faith and sincerity, their truthfulness and piety, is to the writer of these lines not at all justified. Those who are discerning and analytical divide this period of caliphate into two stages. The first part is viewed by them as the span of Islamic expansion and onward march, and the second of stagnation and recession. They identify the first period with the rule of Abu Bakr and Umar, and the latter with the regime of Usman and Ali. To me, such a division is presumptuous. In my view, All the four Khalifas characteristically reflected the vicegerency of prophethood. Apart from their personal merits and distinctions, each one of them displayed the aura of rightly guided caliphate to the point of perfection. This raises the question, quote, what rightly guided caliphate means? Rightly guided caliphate is neither expansion of the Islamic empire or brilliant conquest, nor yet incessant successes against heavy odds. If these were the criteria, we would have to acknowledge Walid bin Abdul Malik and Harun Rashid as the most virtuous khalifas. The rightly guided caliphate is in fact the championship of the Prophet's mental attitude and the way of life. Then, what was the Prophet's frame of mind? It was to give credence to mute realities and truth beyond the ken of human perception. The sincere most disposition to obey God, the willingness to forego the present for the sake of the future and adopting the means for that end. To give precedence to the hereafter and afterlife over the life of this world and to give abstinence a preference over affluence. And finally, to derive least benefit from worldly estate and effects and to allow others to have maximum advantage. These values depict the life of the Prophet, which can be seen from the pages of his biography. This practical demonstration is to be found in the Battle of Badr and trenches, in the journey to Tabuk, in the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, in the conquest of Makkah, and the 33 years of his frugal life after being commissioned to prophethood. Its initial stage is represented by his confinement in the Shaib Abu Talib, and the final one by the night when he died without even a lamp in his house, and his chain mail having already pawned for with the Jews 30 sous of barley. Viewed from this angle, the life and regimes of the first four Khalifas and the period of their rule would be found to be following the pattern of the Prophet's frame of mind and life. Abu Bakr's extraordinary grit and firm resolve to fight the unruly Arabs who had abandoned Islam just after the death of the Prophet, his decision to dispatch the troops under Osama in order to fulfill the Prophet's last wishes at the time when the city of Medina had to be defended against tribes of the peninsula, his decision to wage war against the two most powerful empires in the world at a crucial juncture are symbolic of his faith and obedience to God, which cannot be seen elsewhere, except in the lives of the apostles of God and their successors blessed with such an ambition. At the same time, we find him leading a very simple life, taking a stipend from the public treasury, only as much as that was essential to keep his body and soul together, denying even a sweet dish to his wife and children, and then asking to refund whatever amount he had drawn from the treasury by selling his private property after his death. All these furnish a paradigm of perfect selflessness and a characteristic of the prophets of God. In a similar way, Umar's absolute faith in God in the decisive battle of Yarmouk, fought against the Byzantine and the Iranian empires, his deposing of Khalid bin Walid, the most successful and popular general, appointment of gentle and kind-hearted Abu Ubaidah to take over the place just before the Battle of Yarmouk, his strictness with the governors and military commanders, his decision to allow vengeance to a poor Bedouin against Jabla bin al-Aithman, a chieftain and a ruler of his tribe, show the same characteristics of the Prophet and his conduct. Umar's refusal to take anything not available to the common man during the days of the severe famine and his insistence on it so obdurately that his death was apprehended in case the famine lasted for some time more is enough to show his simple habits, his austerity, frugality, and the traits he had inherited from the Prophet and his predecessors. Similarly, the courageous defiance of Usman to the demands of the rebels and giving preference to die than to resign under duress, absolute simplicity in his mode of living, despite his affluence and riches, entertaining the guests of the state and others with meals, and himself taking only bread with olive oil, constituted the robe of the caliphate he had refused to abandon. These were the distinguishing marks of the Prophet's cousin and the last rightly guided Khalifa. The battles of Jamal and Siffin that were fought by Ali have a shifting trait which he possessed in the same degree as found in his life and the regime of his first three predecessors. Ali's refusal to do anything that compromised with his principles and precepts to strengthen his rule, deposing of the high officials, not conforming to his high standard of piety and morality, the decisions taken by him to preserve the high standard of the caliphate, his life of constant struggle without showing a sign of fatigue, complete disregard for the praises of his friends and criticism of his enemies, his sense of duty, his humility, self-abrogation, honesty and love for truth demonstrate the perfection of Ali's faith. Those betaking the path of the Prophet Sunnah realize that Ali had to face an entirely different and a more difficult situation than his predecessors, but his actions and policies were motivated by the same sense of duty and unflinching faith in God as his predecessors. Certain historians and scholars, unable to fathom the nature of the events and circumstances faced by Ali, consider these as internal strife and rebellion, but we consider Ali to be a victim of the obtaining state of affairs, which he tried to tackle with the best of his intentions and his ability. We believe that the Syrians made a discretionary mistake, which need not have been condemned by us, but Ali, on his part, took an action dictated by his honesty of purpose and love for justice and truth, which raised him to his stage's nearness of God. His simple and frugal living reflected the self-abnegation of the Prophet Abu Bakr and Umar. His life of severe self-discipline was so demanding that no hermit or self-denier of his time could follow the example that was set by Ali and his own official relatives, including his brother Aqil bin Abu Talib, found it too rigorous to be endured by them. The Prophet had in truth and reality inculcated such a perfect faith in God and the life to come in his companions that he had reshaped their behavior, their morals and their lifestyles. It was this conviction which found an expression in their self-denial, frugality in all situations, whether it was success or failure, poverty, misery or regnance. The first four Khalifas were miraculous representation of this very faith and conviction and were known as the rightly guided Khalifa, the Khulafa ar-Rashidun, for their inherited and kept up this classic quality of the Prophet to the pitch and perfection. But those who were ignorant of the nature of this prophetic patrimony took the caliphate to be a succession of a monarchy of enjoying benefits and inheritance of kingship by relatives of the ruler. It was certainly a mistaken view, since the caliphate meant performing the duties of the Prophet, of leading a life of austerity and of taking the least and giving the maximum benefit to people, of understanding and undergoing greatest sacrifices for the welfare of others. There can be no denying the fact that all the rightly guided Khalifas acquitted themselves of this onerous responsibility to the fullness of their ability. Prophethood is really the vicegerency of God, and the caliphate is the vicegerency of the Prophet. God's independence of all that exists is one of the significant divine attributes. God, as the Quran says, feeds and is never fed. It is beyond the competence of man to attain that stage, but the acme of one's perfection lies in providing the maximum benefit to other people while denying oneself as much of it as humanly possible. So far as the divine attribute, the feeder, is concerned, man ought to follow God by being generous and courteous, and for is never fed. He ought to be self-denying and never being under the obligation of others. All the phases and junctures that Islam will have to pass through, in my opinion, have been symbolized within the short 30 years during the rightly guided caliphate's existed. It furnishes a model for all problems in the future. How the faith in God should guide one's behavior during the period of success can be found in the regime of Abu Bakr. What steadfastness and gratitude is required for a believer during the period of glory and grandeur is shown by the rule of Umar. Patience and endurance dictated by the conviction in God during a period of strife and rebellion and lawlessness is revealed by the courage and sufferance of Uthman and Ali had Islamic history to furnish only the precedent of the first two Khalifas, which are in reality the continued exemplification of the same type of situation, the guidance provided by the rightly guided caliphate would have remained incomplete without the specimen to show the Muslims the way during times of stress and difficulty. The nation of Islam had to abide to the end of time and thereafter, and therefore it is needed paradigms of all possibilities of life that man will have to undergo. It is therefore required illustrations of both types to guide the behavior and the morals. This need was fulfilled completely and in all aspects by this dual phase of the rightly guided caliphate in the initial period of Islamic history. Jazakallah khair. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.